Hey SEOs and content marketers, say goodbye to crazy spreadsheet mashups and experience unprecedented connectivity between your SEO planning and reporting data. Introducing Audience Key, technology for keyword mapping, content brief automation, and rank tracking that form an SEO strategy system providing unparalleled feedback loops between planning, reporting, and optimization activities. Put your time and energy into strategy, not data upkeep. Visit audiencekey.com and apply for a free trial today.
Everyone, welcome to Webcology here on WMR.fm. It is the day before Thanksgiving. It is the 27th of November, Wednesday, the 27th of November. We normally record this show live to podcast on Thursdays. This Thursday, tomorrow, of course, is in the United States, Thanksgiving. This is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media and Christine Schackinger from Sites Without Walls wishing all of you a happy Thanksgiving. And Christine, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving. I know yours isn't this week, though.
No, ours. I'm up in Canada, and as you might imagine, it's getting kind of cold up here. We tend to celebrate our Thanksgiving when it's warm enough to travel house to house without freezing. Second weekend in October, so ours was October the 14th, which for a lot of Canadian tech workers makes for a weird series of holidays because most of us work with American companies. And often, you know, take the American holiday. I'm taking a 4-day weekend.
Yay!
Thank goodness. Americans don't get nearly as much time off as Canadians, and we don't get nearly as much time off as our European counterparts. But the idea of any of us having a 4-day long weekend is just, you know, it's kind of wonderful and phenomenal and all too rare.
Yes.
Except around this time of season, because it's getting to smell a lot like Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which come up, actually we're going to come up after people hear this podcast. Black Friday is 2 days from recording day, and Cyber Monday, of course, is this coming Monday. Pretty much anything you could have done to your client websites needed to be done by now. And from now until, well, I guess the end of the year, it's that weird time in tech. For SEOs, it's almost like a slow dead time, at least for commercial SEOs.
Yeah, though I do advise people that they should get audits during this time of year. We talked about this last time because everything's slow. You can do the audit and be ready to run in like January, as opposed to like getting it in January and not being ready to run till March.
There you go. Yeah. Audits can be turned around pretty quickly. I just did just spent my morning doing a small mini audit for a site in North Michigan.
Nice.
That was fun. Okay, so moving into the American 4-day Thanksgiving long weekend, we have a major algorithm update. A major core update that's continuing on. Google's November 2024 core update should be ending any time now, except according to the usual sources, it's getting all hot again. What do you think, Christine? What is happening with this update?
I have several clients and we're doing core update recovery, and I am seeing most of the movement in the last week. Like, it wasn't doing anything the first week. So, and we're 16 days in. They said 2 weeks. So you're right. It should be over pretty soon. Hopefully, before the holiday ends, but probably not till after the holiday. If they haven't done it today. So I've seen a lot of movement on sites in a positive way. We're getting a bit of those hockey sticks that we always live for, which is really good news.
So there's proof that recoveries are possible and that, core updates are the time that Google, shakes everything up in the hopes that it will settle in the way that I don't know how to predict that it will settle. We've been reporting on the independent web publishers, and we're talking thousands and thousands of them who lost position during the HCU. Any talk of improvements in their quarters?
No, I haven't heard anything. I do have a client that appears to be getting some recovery in that area, but they also had two core update issues before, so it's hard to know. that other people saying they're seeing the same thing. But they are seeing that, let me know on the socials, because we didn't do any extra work and they already had a core update recovery in August. So the fact that they're getting a pretty big jump right now would likely be related to the HCU, but it could also be other core update factors that they didn't reward last time. So.
Okay. More WordPress drama. Remember WP Engine was, I think it's fair to say absolutely targeted by Matt Mullenweg and Atomic. They went to court to try to get an injunction against against Atomic. They got most of what they wanted. They were the judge is inclined to grant some sort of injunction. However, the request for the injunction was too vague.
Yeah. So she's likely to give it as long as they rephrase or recontextualize what they're after.
To recap, Matt Mullenweg has pretty much shut WP Engine out of the WordPress environment and community, taken over many of WP Engine's core products, redirected many of WP Engine's core clients, created loyalty tests for WordPress users, just to prove that they're not actually associated with those guys over at WP Engine. And you know what? I don't think I've even mentioned the half of it yet.
Yeah, well, and you say his name better than I do. Mullenweg. Apparently demanded $32 million with no basis for the $32 million. So
did he want them in small, unmarked bills, preferably 50s and 20s?
I'm thinking so. In like little bags left in the backyard or something. Yeah, no, they, the lawyer for WP Engine did call it extortion. And it kind of sounds like it kind of was a little bit. Because apparently, you know, for so many years, I think it's 12 years, there was no issue. And all of a sudden, they wanted $32 million. So the lawyer said, that's not how you calculate a royalty. That's how you set a ransom. And since there was no financial basis for it, no documents to back it up, no violations of the orders that, you know, the agreements that they had between them, it kind of sounds like that. So we'll see what the judge decides once they get a better framework for their argument. But
we'll see where that one goes.
This one does feel like justice is going in the right direction, though.
Yeah. Again, we'll see where it goes. I hope that they can come up with a better definition of damage that was done to them and why. And it's not like Automatic and WordPress is doing this, because it's not WordPress exactly. It's Automatic and Mullenweg and the corporate structure of WordPress, but it is WordPress.
It is, but it is the corporate side, though he owns both. But.
Okay, but it's not like it's outside of the realm of their behavior. I mean, just recently, Automatic cloned WP Engine's ACF premium plugin and is now distributing it for free.
Yeah, people in the community are not happy about it, so well, I don't know how far they're going to get.
Fork that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Seriously, straight up, that's what they did. They forked it and claimed it.
They forked it and claimed it, and now they're giving it away for free. But because the WordPress community is not like just regular users who are like, oh, good, free, and don't care, they're very vested in the community and the ecosystem of WordPress, so they're very angry that he has done this and that he's offering it for free. Undercut WP Engine, who's the one who owned it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just being vested in the community. It's vested in the philosophy of open source development.
Yeah.
This is watching a web, part of the web's world order change. And it's not a voluntary change. It's being forced on us by money.
Well, yeah, because if we go back to just the original ask for $32 million, the way the plaintiff or the lawyer for WP Engine put it, She revealed new details. This is from Search Engine Journal. She revealed new details of how Mullenweg decided on the $32 million, explaining that it was just a number that Mullenweg felt WP Engine was able to pay.
Yeah,
and
so
that it wasn't based on any factual information.
The whole trip to open source was the grassroots development community sets around the powerful.
Yeah.
You know, we together are much more powerful than the powerful. We can make our own resources. We can vet our own resources. We can prove our own resources. We can share them with all of us so that we can prove other stuff. And, you know, it is the foundation of, so it's the foundation of GitHub. It's the foundation of how we build our jobs. So many people are employed because of the philosophy of the open source movement.
Yeah, and they said that they felt like the plaintiff, that they felt like he was just trying to get whatever he could squeeze out of WP Engine because the rate was set in an extortionate manner, which is true. $32 million is a lot of money for something that, by the way,
it's not like WP Engine hasn't made $32 million off the back of WordPress. They have.
But it's also not like WordPress itself hasn't been rewarded greatly by the presence of WP Engine, which, as we both know, was actually encouraged by Automattic back in the day to take on the hosting because they didn't want to deal with the hosting for WordPress anymore and they needed a better hosting.
Yeah, so, WordPress grew because of WP Engine's actions.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's ugly and it's dumb and this probably shouldn't be happening. But you know what? There's a lot of that going around. This next story is also ugly, dumb, and definitely shouldn't be happening.
Maybe that should be the tagline for the internet these days. Ugly and dumb. Shouldn't be happening.
We're entering the second quarter of the 21st century. This is the end, the last month of the first quarter of the 21st century. And yeah, that should be the tagline for all of it. Something dumb that probably shouldn't have happened that way.
Exactly.
So.
This is really dumb, though.
This is awful. Bill Slosky is an SEO legend. He was also a friend of mine and a friend of Christine's, like a personal friend. I knew Bill. We all came up together. Bill was Bill actually went to law school, had a law degree, never practiced law. He didn't achieve the bar, but he had a law degree. And this is how he was able to understand extreme documents like every patent ever written. Bill was also kind of crazy genius kind of guy who lived in patents. He understood them like you would understand a 3D model. And he died. He had a series of strokes and died, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, forever ago. But just yesterday at the same time. And, he's an absolute legend in the SEO world. He's the one who defined so much of how we understand how Google and Bing work. So some goof is out there pretending to be him on Blue Sky, had a fake Bill Slosky account on Blue Sky, and John McAlpern. SEO John McAlpern has outed him. Now, he's not naming him. He's not putting his name up or anything, but he just wants the fake Bill Slosky to know, and he wants everybody out there. Like, go to, if you're on Blue Sky, you should be following John McAlpern. Go to his profile. It's right there. He's not hiding it. And you'll see the IP address and technical information of the fake Bill Slosky. No names. He's not being doxxed or nothing like that. But fake Bill Slosky, in case you're listening, I don't know why you would be because you're fake, but in case you are, we know you are. There's people out there who do know who you are. And stop. Stop.
Yeah, that's wrong. And the post on Blue Sky are just dumb, and he keeps repeating something called mommy milkers. I don't even know what that is.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's just, I don't know if the person was trying to be funny or whatever, but it's not funny. The man died of, you know, a stroke. He's beloved by the community. He's one of our biggest contributors. So not cool, not okay. And thank you for John for posting that information, because apparently after John posted that information, he stopped posting.
Good. Well, yeah. Good. You know, that's that Liam Nielsen line, or particular set of people with a particular set of skills. Don't screw with us.
Yeah, and again, no one's been doxxed here. It's just the information about his phone and like that he used incognito and stuff like that. But and that he's in San Antonio, Texas. That's about all we know. So thank you for putting an end to that awfulness.
Okay, so this is a hard one to. This is an impossible circle to square. AI is going to revolutionize so many things. It's going to completely change the way we do medicine, the way we do at-scale scientific research. AI will map the oceans for us. AI will do so many extraordinary, amazing things, and AI will also be used to cheat creativity.
Yes.
Double-edged sword. AI will get us to other planets, and AI might help us get through the climate crisis. And AI is going to produce a whole bunch of craptastic art based on stuff that people have already created, and thus devaluing the concept of art itself, and certainly devaluing the work that it stole from. So, an early version of Sora was actually shut down by OpenAI.
Oh, OpenAI, we didn't explain what Sora is. Sora is their new video tech, text-to-video generator. So we talked about it a long time ago, but it's been a while, so people have probably forgotten the name. So the new version of it was leaked this week. And Jim, by who leaked it?
Someone on X, maybe?
Yeah, the artists who were had access to Sora were kind of angry about the whole thing, and so they leaked it. And it got shut down pretty soon after, but the leak was orchestrated by a group of beta testers, many of whom were visual artists and filmmakers. Posting under the name Soro PR Puppets, the group released the model alongside an open letter addressed to the corporate AI overlords. This was on Newsweek this week. And they cited grievances over unpaid labor, which I totally get, and unethical business practice. And 380 verified artists have signed this petition. So,
what do you think about it? Like, do you remember when that Banksy, that the moment it was sold, the moment the gavel went down at Sotheby's, the Banksy shredded itself?
Yes, I thought that was amazing.
That's what this reminds me of. And the group of artists did state that as artists, they were invited to provide feedback and experimental work without fair compensation, while OpenAI stood to gain substantial public relations and marketing value from their efforts. Well, you know, this is feedback. They just leaked it.
Yeah, and this is from the same article. The alleged OpenAI, currently valued at $150 billion, exploited their labor by relying on unpaid or undercompensated contributions to refine Sora. Refine, they have to do with models like this because they don't work without refinement. This wasn't just about unpaid work. It was about respect. Noted one anonymous contributor on Hugging Face. OpenAI treated our input like raw material, not creative expertise. It's not collaboration, it's extraction. I really like that quote. It's extraction. And then they said, we received access to Sora with the promise to be early testers, red teamers, and creative partners. However, we believe instead we are being lured into art washing to tell the world that Sora is a useful tool for artists. I also like that too, art washing. So
again, I think stealing it and releasing it is fair comment on their part.
It is, because their stuff was stolen to train, and they were never given compensation. And OpenAI spent a lot of time denying that they actually did that when, of course, then we found out sure that they did.
Now, again, as I said before, artificial intelligence is going to do incredible things for humankind. It is. It's centupling our creative and intellectual prowess. But it's going to do a whole bunch of bad stuff too, because this is Earth. Everything comes with, has dual nature on this, in this place. For every birth, there's a death. And for every artist that says you can't use my stuff, there's a bomb waiting to be dropped, or a target waiting to be targeted, or a military application waiting to be exploited, and that's the next major land grab for the AI companies, especially in the heightening conflicts, so the heightening conflict in Ukraine. So yeah, that's something to look for in the near future. AI is coming to a military industrial complex near you.
And all of it, not just one company, all the companies are seeking these out. And I understand why, because the contracts are very big, very lucrative. And once you're in that pipeline, they provide a steady stream of cash flow. But the idea that these are all going to be used with, like, DOD, with no restrictions, no guidelines, no oversight, is a little concerning. So, we don't know much more than that right now. We just know they're pursuing it. So, OpenAI, Meta, you know, all the AI companies are looking to get these government contracts with defense, Department of Defense.
Dig deep while you sleep. Dig deep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What else do we have happening out here?
Look, something cool.
Okay, I don't understand.
Which one?
Okay, no, I you know what? I like this story better. This is a much nicer story. So, there's a company called Near Space Labs, based in New York. It's going to be deploying a network of high-altitude balloons equipped with advanced robotic cameras to basically capture high-res images of disaster-prone places across the states. California is having incredible wildfires. Beaches are eroding on the East Coast. Parts of Louisiana are being reclaimed by the ocean so much faster than the U.S. Corps of Engineers can keep up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Southwest is drying up. The breadbasket is also drying up. So these balloons, using AI-enabled robots called SWIFTs, are going to be out there capturing image with a resolution of like 7 centimeters per pixel.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And they're going to be at the altitudes of 60,000 to 85,000 feet. And they can map a large disaster zone within hours instead of weeks.
Okay, sorry.
Nope, go ahead.
Just a quick note to the Air Forces, to the Royal Canadian Air Force and to the USAF. These aren't Chinese balloons. Leave them alone.
Yeah. Well, I kind of left that one alone, too. No, these are going to be able to map disaster areas and climate change areas very quickly, so we can be more proactive about what we do on the ground. So that'll be very good.
Not like we actually are going to be, but, you know, so we can be if we want to be.
Exactly.
Okay, so don't put a link in your tweet. Actually, I don't even know why you're making a tweet or an X at Xter to begin with. But if you do, I mean, if you do want to be associated with those people, don't put a link in it, because you're going to get suppressed if you do.
Yeah, he calls it. Okay, I am there for good reasons, but I'm moving towards Blue Sky. But Musk calls it lazy linking. I don't know what that means. No, does anybody else?
It means that Musk wants to control the flow of information, and he won't let people link out of the X environment.
You can link to it in the next tweet, the post subtweet. He'll let you do that, but if you want your thing to get any traction, then you can't have any links in it, which is just weird. Facebook did that for a little while too, suppressed like pages with links. That's why you'll see a lot of pages will put the link below the actual story in the comments. I don't understand why that's supposed to do anything. I mean, like, why suppressing the links is supposed to do anything. They said that they wanted to keep people on the site maybe, but there's an article
this one is at MSN.com.
Well, no, they're all MSN's. MSN reposts everybody else's article syndication. So this was actually from some
Jesus, they should have a podcast. Jeez.
Yeah. They're from Slate. And so basically that nobody clicked in Twitter anyway. Nobody clicked out. It wasn't a thing, because when you came to Twitter, people came to get the most recent news and information, not to click out to go read it. Like, they wanted to see what people were saying and discussing. So the fact that he's doing this actually doesn't even mean anything because people already were not clicking on them, but now he's deprioritizing any posts with links. So if you're still on Twitter, be aware that that's going on. Blue Sky does seem to be the new place to be, though.
Oh, Blue Sky is lovely. I'm actually participating there.
Yay!
I'm posting things to Blue Sky almost daily. I'm talking to people back and forth. There is no hate yet. And anytime hate does arise, it gets removed pretty fast.
That's great. Yeah, I've been on it for a little bit now, but yeah, I'm not getting hit by 50 trolls every hour.
Will that environment remain that way forever? Probably not. Blue Sky is going to have to scale eventually as it gets more and more and more users, and scaling costs money. What happens when things cost money? You got to raise it somehow. How do you tend to raise it on the web? Advertising, and that wonks everything. So we'll see what happens with Blue Sky. But I'll tell you straight up, I'd be willing to spend money to be part of the Blue Sky community if it was to stay this way.
So, me too. And I haven't seen the issue with bots and fake accounts and stuff yet. So, although there had to be an issue in Twitter's registration system for the way that those appeared, because like 300,000 would get registered at the same time. So you don't do that by having 300,000 people go and create accounts. So as long as that, Blue Sky keeps their security locked down where that's not possible, it'll be much less likely it'll happen there.
Yeah. Now, I honestly, I don't know why. Christine, you have reasons for participating at Twitter. I dissuade anybody who can go to, who's going to Twixter to be at Twixter. But if you're at LinkedIn still, and there's good reason to be at LinkedIn, as annoying as that place is, LinkedIn is trying to improve itself. It's sharing do's and don'ts for better post visibility. And in sharing these posts, I think it's also trying to improve the levels of engagement and the tone of engagement. I mean, I don't think LinkedIn wants engagement for engagement's sake. It wants engagement to get you employed. Or to, improve your career or whatever. Because I do believe LinkedIn wants to be a business and a vocation-focused network.
Yeah, and to that end, I have seen it pick up quite a bit lately. I have like this gut reaction to LinkedIn when I first get on there that is not pleasant. Like my body's like, no. But I do get a lot of information out there. I've gotten quite a few bits of work. And so it is nice that they're putting out at least some guidance on how to do well over there. My posts do fairly well, but I don't get like 20,000 views or something very often. But the things that they're telling people that they favor are industry insights, career development tips, business advice, professional news, substantive market analysis. This is Search Engine Journal. That address like they're more likely to get boosted because they are shared beyond a user's immediate connections. Because of the type of content. What they want you to avoid is promotional or off-topic content. Yeah, that's obvious. These are all pretty obvious. Engagement bait, unoriginal content, of course, unconstructive posts, like foster dismissive, derisive, or unconstructive conversations that can damage relationships or stifle dialogue, and adult and sensitive content. You will not find Pornhub posting pictures on
No thirst pics.
They want you to add unique insights when you share others' content, include practical industry knowledge with promotional posts, encourage meaningful professional discussions, and maintain civil and constructive dialogue. So those are the tips right now.
To be really clear, LinkedIn does not mind self-promotion. In fact, LinkedIn's all about self-promotion. But if you're going to be self-promotional, offer people useful insights.
Right.
Offer industry knowledge. Offer something that shows why you as a professional should be listened to or should be heeded. That's what LinkedIn's for.
Yeah, it's the difference of me saying, here's how we recovered a site from an algorithmic devaluation. Oh, and I do audits. Or, I do audits. Hire me. So
that's kind of the difference. Nobody cares about the latter statement. But if Christine shares, I do audits, and here's something I found that was really interesting.
Which is every audit these days.
Oh, very, very possibly. But you know what I mean, though, right? You're giving something to the community. LinkedIn's like, good. That's a value to the community. That's good. But if you're just like doing the equivalent of post spam, LinkedIn would like to discourage you. And hopefully makes LinkedIn a more livable environment.
Ooh.
And that would be lovely, eh?
And you'll be there someday. I was tagging Jim in the stories, not realizing he didn't go to LinkedIn.
Well, I do go to LinkedIn every once in a while. I just don't like it because every time I do, I'm hit up for stuff that I didn't want to be solicited for in the first place.
Well, it was funny because I was sending you stories for the week. I'm like, why doesn't Jim ever mention these? Oh, because he's not actually going to read them.
Another problem with LinkedIn I have, and this is a terrible thing. Fans of the podcast reach out on LinkedIn, and they also reach out on Facebook and Twixter and now Blue Sky and stuff, which is wonderful. But on LinkedIn, I'm never sure if I'm being solicited or not, and I feel so guilty when I don't get back to people. I feel insanely guilty. Like a fan took the time to write in, like, oh my gosh, that's enormous, right?
It is.
Like, it's seriously, that reminds us why we do what we do. You gotta reply to that. But at LinkedIn, I'm never sure if I'm being solicited or not, and I just feel squidgely and weird about it, so I just don't go there. I avoid it.
You know how I know they're being solicited. Hi, I love your website. Hi, I was looking at your website. Hi, your website's fantastic. I don't have a website.
You weren't looking at my website. You don't love my website, trust me. Yeah, I don't love my website.
There before you spam me.
Okay, where are we going next?
Well, you know, we can just kind of go on down the line here and talk about YouTube expanding like creator tools. If you do YouTube, you know, you're getting more creator tools. You're getting, a content disclosure system. You're getting cross-platform sharing that's going to be streamlined with direct access to YouTube's creation features. So, you know, it's a lot of good little, they got longer shorts now, sort of like the progression of TikTok, right? TikTok was like 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 3 minutes. Right? Now we're at like an hour or something. Now they're extending how long you can have your shorts. And they're going to organize the shorts on your subscriptions page. Revamped video sharing from other apps. So you're going to be able to share from other apps more easily. Images on quiz posts. I did not know this was a thing. Did you know this was a thing? That there are quizzes on YouTube?
Yes. Actually,
I did not know that. So there's following the launch of text-based quiz posts, you can now optionally add images to the multiple choice answers in your quizzes.
The cool thing about all of this is it's extraordinarily good marketing tools. The horrible thing about what YouTube is doing is it's making it so easy for more web pollution to go up. If you're on Facebook or on YouTube itself, how much time do you find that you're spending on short videos now?
Depends what mood I'm in. I don't.
The TikTokification of Facebook.
I don't love them on other platforms. Like, there's something about TikTok, the way they're done, maybe the authenticity of them. Because usually everything on Facebook is somebody taking it from TikTok and putting it on Facebook. Like, Facebook will cut it at a certain time, yeah, so they'll never get the full video. So I'm like screenshotting the name of the TikTok person so I could go watch the full video, and then I download it and then I upload it so everyone can see the full video. So, you know, the limitations on Facebook, the silly limitations, like, oh, we cut it at 60 seconds, but it's a 2-minute video, so that does not help me. Yeah, I watch it mostly on TikTok. I do watch some on Facebook. I don't think I watch any shorts on YouTube.
I found myself sometimes on YouTube and sometimes on Facebook being just stuck in shorts. And I don't know, I find them to be web pollution, but addictive web pollution, web crack.
Okay. Oh, by the way, there's a couple more features that in the YouTube thing that people will probably really like. There's Transformer and Dream Screen posts. So you can use text input to generate images. There'll be an open call pilot program, which will be advertisers to ask for custom ads from creators if you're eligible. That's kind of cool. And then there's disclosure for camera. I can't speak to you. Blah, 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 blah. I'm tripping over my tongue. Camera captured content. Say that 3 times fast. Camera captured content. Disclosure on where it came from. So if it was shot with the camera, that's that C2PA that we've talked about before.
Indeed, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, they're going to be. It's going to be in the description box.
And can you imagine in the future how that's going to link into like people's goggles? Because eventually goggles are going to catch on or some form of a visual web.
I don't know because, okay. I'll let you finish. I'm just going to tell you a story, not in the grid, if you had so many. But Facebook is giving up its like Oculus pop-ups where people can try it because nobody's using it. So,
Facebook is giving up on Oculus.
Or at least the pop-ups. They did the pop-ups where people could try it.
Oh, sure. I can. Okay, I can see that.
But apparently people aren't using it. Like people aren't interested when they have the pop-ups, so they're closing them down. So
Well,
we'll
yeah,
see.
you need a massive environment and something fun for people, I think, to adopt that as an environment. I think that an overlay for your sunglasses is coming sooner than later. I'd be really
Yeah.
surprised. I'm surprised that it isn't here now.
I think the only thing is, like, my friend had them, and we went to his house for dinner, and he had a roller coaster ride, and it was super cool for about 30 seconds. And then I could even feel the G-forces, which is weird because I'm not on the roller coaster, but I started to feel very sick. And then my friend tried it. She started to feel very sick. And there's something about those type of goggles that affect a lot of people that way. So
Yeah,
I
sure.
have a feeling that's its friction point, is that, yeah, it's great for 30 seconds, but I feel I'm going to throw up. Yeah.
Okay, so this the two these are two news stories. They're kind of linked with each other. TikTok is going to be blocking beauty filters for teens because of mental health concerns,
which is good.
Which is good. And Australia is days away from banning social media accounts for children under 16, and we're looking at fines that could be up to 10 million for every violation, and, you know, 32 million American for systemic breaches once it just keep happening over and over and over again.
And that's what the platform
along
not
with
the
teeth.
users. So if you
Well,
want, that's what the
indeed.
platform not the users.
They will be targeting the platforms, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I mean, the kid, like the number one, we covered this story before, the number one site for kids 7 to 9 is Twitter. Because parents weren't locking it down because they didn't think of it as a kids app. So the idea that kids shouldn't have access to this stuff, I think is a good idea. I don't think you're mentally ready. Maybe 18's a little high, but I think before like age 13, it's a little rough. Especially as we're talking
I
about this
don't
stuff.
think people over age 18 are mentally ready for what's become of Twixter,
Yeah.
to be honest.
Oh, I just mean in general, but you're right. Yeah, no, very true. But you know, the mental health issues among teens, especially with the filters, because you know, you and I are old enough. We look at it and we go, oh, that person has a filter on. I mean, come on, you look great, but we know that's not you. But when you're that age, you don't know that. And you see all these girls your age and they have no acne and everything's perfect. And, you know, they're glowing and it's all filters. Some of the filters are very subtle. They just make you look better. So they will have to let them put funny animal faces on those. That's good. Funny ears and all the cute stuff, which is what a kid under 13 should probably be doing anyway. But yes, I think it's a positive move. I think the fines in Australia are probably I don't know if they're the largest, but they sure sound like some of the largest we've ever heard of. For allowing the kids access, because it is a hard thing to control.
Well, indeed. How to say this? There is social media has become the information source for most people who start using it, and a lot of the content at social media is patently false. It's completely wrong. It's rage
Yeah.
bait. It's designed to misinform and piss off the viewer, and it's a threat to a well-informed populace, which is a threat to democracy, and letting young people who haven't been through school, who don't know their maths, don't know literature, and certainly haven't been taught history, having them be exposed to the falsity and rage bait of social media, especially Twixter,
especially, but
is
they're
a
all
crime
bad.
against their intellects.
Yeah, but they're all bad. We know that. You know, when you report stuff on Facebook or Meta or Instagram, it
No,
doesn't come down.
they're horrible. They're all
No.
horrible. They're designed to manipulate the users into disliking themselves and their community. That's exactly what social media does. And we all feel awful after using it, but we use it anyway because it's the way we communicate with each other. And legit, Now that the major news gathering organizations are, you know, falling by the wayside, it is the way we share information with each other, as misinforming as it might be.
True.
It's the new circle of life, Christine. It's just not a very good one. Okay, so Microsoft has recently released a new Bing wallpaper app into the Microsoft Store, and I think it might actually be on some Windows computers now.
You know, and if you think it's just a wallpaper app, it's Microsoft, so it is not.
Yeah, there's weird stuff going on in the background.
It'll automatically install Bing Visual Search on your computer and has the code to peruse and decrypt your Edge and Chrome cookies.
So Microsoft knows what you're doing.
Yeah, a little bit of not malware, because it's not a hacker somewhere in the basement, but it's not something you probably want to put on your computer or your phone. So that's hard apparently to get off. Surprise, surprise.
There is a new feature on my desktop. And I'm just trying to close all my windows now so I can go to it. And I haven't clicked on it yet. I'm getting a new image every day. And this happened after the most recent Microsoft update. And there is a link, learn about this image. And I haven't clicked it yet because there's just something, you know, shady about that link. I'm worried about clicking it.
We have been taught well.
Oh, we have. If the big houses are offering it, it's probably a trap.
Yes, very much so. So moving on to something positive for Microsoft, we are now getting AI SEO tips on how to rank and get into their search engine, how to do well in the search engine. And one of the big pieces of advice is keywords aren't it anymore, which everybody should kind of know that now because of entities and natural language processing, but Microsoft is relying heavily on natural language processing, so it's crucial for ranking in the search engines, which means writing like simple answers, simple questions that are well constructed grammatically so that the machine learning can understand it. So it's not just the keyword in there, but it's also that the intent is matching what you're writing about. So you can't just put dog 50 times. You have to know why someone's searching for dog and that your article is going to match when the NLP gets to work.
Here's how I'm trying to write to this new reality. Have you ever had a inquisitive conversation with a really, really intelligent child?
I have.
So the child, you'll say something, and the child will ask why. And you'll say something, and the child will ask why. And you'll say something, and the child will ask why. And you're explaining things step by step by step by step. And there's a linear process to the entire conversation. That's how you got to think about writing for the new AIs. You're answering a question that any average person might ask upon reading this content. Somebody's here for a reason. They're presuming they want knowledge. You're giving it to them in a very linear fashion.
Exactly. And I was one of those children, my mom says, that annoyed her to death. But so they're saying that the strategic keyword implementation should be more around long tail keywords for specific user interests, conversational phrases matching natural speech patterns, semantic keywords providing contextual relevance, question-based keywords addressing common user queries. This is from Search Engine Journal. Basically, when you write it, read it out loud. Does it sound natural? Does it sound like it flows? Is it simply constructed? If you're using multiple compound sentences and it's not academic writing, then the search engine is probably going to have a problem with that. They're looking for simple sentence construction because that's how NLP works best. And they love questions. NLP loves questions because the way you phrase a question is almost standard all the time. So they can more easily understand that it is a question and that there should be an answer following it. They also want you to keep your content updated using Index Now protocol as well. That's the one where you can list the URLs you want into the search engine. And there's also an article on Search Engine Roundtable here about getting your stuff indexed into ChatGPT search. And you want to make sure that you're doing that. The things for that as well. That's technical implementation, like your site's good for technical, that you have content attribution, things like that in your content. You can look at that in the same article. There's a link there. So the article we're looking at was from Matt Southern at Search Engine Journal and Microsoft's AI SEO tips. So it's really pretty good. So it's a content must focus on user intent, not just keywords, natural language processing, crucial for ranking, regular content updates, essential for maintaining visibility in AI search, because when it trains on something, it needs new content. Now, if you're a dictionary site, you're not going to change all your content all the time. You don't need to. But if you're a site where you can add content, create new content, make fresh content, then you want to do that to encourage it to come back and to keep training on what you're doing. And that's about it. Pretty
okay.
simple.
This is a weird one. And I'm not sure how to make sense of these numbers, but Google and the DOJ are going through the final motions of the antitrust case regarding Google's digital advertising technology.
Which is not the UK case, and it's not the other case we talked about earlier. This is a different case.
No, this is a different case. This is the one that this isn't the one where Google's threatened, or where the DOJ is threatening to sever Android and Chrome. This is yet a different one.
Yes.
Okay, so they're hearing, they're in the final arguments. No judgments have been made in this case yet. And in the final argument, the Department of Justice comes out with a statement saying Google controls 91% of the ad market.
For published ad servers.
Couple seconds later, Google comes along, and in their closing argument, say they control 10% of the ad market.
Quite a difference there. That the Google holds about 91% of the market for publisher ad servers and 87% for advertiser ad networks is the determination. And Google goes, no, 10%.
That's quite the discrepancy.
Quite a bit, just a little bit.
So, why the discrepancy, Kristen? I don't understand. Like, this blows my mind that I can see the DOJ. I think they're probably closer to reality.
I think they're closer to reality, yeah. Well,
is Google, like, counting the classified ads in the newspaper?
Kind of. So DOJ sees digital advertising as three markets: ad servers, ad exchanges, advertiser ad networks. I think in our industry, we'd probably pretty much agree on those, right? Pretty much where people buy ads, sell ads, those are the places. Google argues digital advertising is a two-sided market, buyers of ads, sellers of ads. So by that definition, when Google also believes they compete against social media companies like Meta and TikTok and streaming services, even though the streaming service is not related to the search engine or social, they're considering the ads there as well. So when you consider all of those locations, they say they're only 10% of the market. And right now, I guess it's how you define the lemon, you know, but yeah, I'm going with the 87 to 91% as being much closer, because, that's like saying my competitor is, my competitor is the mom and pop print shop down the road, you know, and that's not the case. So, and I think the definitions for DOJ are much closer. Ad servers, exchanges, and ad networks is pretty much how I know people define it. So they're saying that, like, publishers say they must use Google's full ad stack to earn more money. Advertisers feel they have few options to reach large audiences, and small businesses worry about rising advertising costs. These are part of the things that the government has used to declare Google's dominance in an antitrust case as well. And remind people, it's not illegal to be a monopoly. It's illegal to be one that holds so much of the market, and they make it unfair for everybody else to compete. So, so we'll see what happens. She's not going to write the ruling until the end of the year.
Okay, so Google's facing down a £7 billion UK class action over search monopoly. This isn't like the one we just talked about that's happening in the United States, nor is it the one that we were talking about that's happening in the United States. This is the one. Oh, it's not even the one that's happening in Europe. This is the one that's happening in the UK. And it's for £7 billion, which I'm sure you can agree, Christine, is quite weighty.
8.8 billion US dollars. So not like we normally talk about, where it's a little slap on the wrist and they can shake the couch for the change. And this is a class action lawsuit. So this was not just like company after company. This was, a group. Saying that they are harming consumers and stifling competition. And the UK's Competition Appeal Tribunal, CAT, ruled Friday that the case led by consumer advocate Nikki Stopford can proceed. This is in search engine land.
Okay, and so What they're alleging, what they're saying is that Google has forced Android dominance over manufacturers. They're forcing manufacturers to pre-install Google Search in Chrome. They're paying Apple billions to secure itself as the default search engine in Safari, the dominant web browser on Apple devices. That they control the costs of ad pricing and they can use their heft to indirectly inflate consumer prices throughout the UK. And that Google rigs basically what we all sort of accept to be true, and that the DOJ itself found that Google, in fact, rigs the search marketing, the search engine market, to charge advertisers more. And they can, and they can use their heft to do that, which, of course, affects all consumers.
But Google says that we just pick it because it's better. That's why.
Which actually may well be true. Google may be picked by advertisers. No, my consumers think it's a better product, but it's still manipulative as hell.
Yes, it is. It's very manipulative, and they control the market. And so, like we did, like we're going to talk about in a few minutes, they can tell you to spend money just to keep your ads going, and they'll give you a reason why. So, yeah, their whole goal is to make as much money on ads as possible. It is kind of crazy how many lawsuits they have right now, though. Like, this is a massive one. Because, you know, and Google has spent its whole career with the biggest lobbyists in the United States at times, and if not the number one in the top five, to make sure these things don't happen. But now they have the USDA DOJ lawsuit, which already has been decided that they were an illegal monopoly, the antitrust case in the EU, this antitrust case in the UK, the other one about the advertising networks, and I think there's two or three we have covered before, but they haven't progressed so far, so we don't know about them.
You really need a scorecard to keep up.
You do. I think we need to make a website, Jim, that's just about the cases that Google has. Actually, someone's already done that, but you just have to Google it and even have the court case documents. But yeah, it's kind of crazy. You can't really argue against most of these assertions because they are all true. It's just whether they're illegal or not. That'll be the final determination.
But, well, and how to say it? What they're doing in the old universe is completely illegal. In the universe dominated by newspapers where, say, the New York Times was so big it could push around the New York Post and control advertising revenues for all the other broadsheets. We're not in that world. We're in a digital world where things move a lot faster and consumers tend to make more centralized choices. That's just the nature of the internet. So we'll see how these things work out in the long run. Because again, what Google's doing, and the antitrust laws are quite clear, but they were written in a different era.
Yeah, it's just kind of crazy though how many lawsuits they are now under and serious verdicts so far, very serious verdicts so far.
And there's a good reason for that if you consider how incredibly powerful Google is.
I think that the odds.
If Google wants to cut you, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If Google wants to cut you off, Google will cut you off. And when Google cuts you off, that's a bunch of traffic you've been cut off from. Ask any independent publisher. At least independent publishers that enjoyed almost a decade of strong rankings. They'll tell you, when it's gone, it's gone.
The weird thing is, sorry, I saw that you're coming with a thing, but not in time. The weird thing is that they keep doing antitrust like stuff, like monopoly stuff. They're like, we're going to do this new thing. And I forgot it was yesterday. But anyway, every other day, it seems like there's a new announcement of something that is totally based on being an illegal monopoly. And it's just very odd to me because you're under all these cases, one judgment where they might even break part of you up. Another one's going to be maybe $8.8 billion. Looks like that's probably going to go the other way for them too. And it just seems kind of odd that they keep doubling down on being being a monopoly. So,
well, that's one of the reasons I keep wondering if this is just the nature of the beast, given the environment they're working in. The web does tend towards centralization, while reality tends towards localization. You live in Las Vegas. I live in Toronto. I'm not interested in Las Vegas news, as fascinating as it might be, but you're quite interested in Las Vegas news. I doubt you're very interested in Toronto news, as fascinating as it might be. Reality tends to what's around us, but the web tends to, is the web is, you know, one big thing that tends to centralize. Google is the biggest thing on the web. It's like gravity. It's like its own massive gravity well. Things just get attracted to it.
Exactly. And then they capture it and they won't let it go.
Well, yeah, once you get in the orbit, once you get in the orbit of something so big, it's hard to fling out of it. And once you do fling out of it, you're in outer space, baby. Ain't nothing out there. Ask Forbes. They'll tell you. Okay, so this next story, actually, but before we even went to air, I had to talk to Christine about it because it incites me, because this is just, I think this is one of the stupid SEO moves of all time. And I understand why they did it and why they made the choice. But, okay, so just before the crackdown, just before the site reputation abuse crackdown happened, Forbes Advisor moved itself to a subdomain.
No, off the subdomain to the path level.
I'm sorry, off the subdomain onto the path level. So it changed its file structure entirely. There's speculation that they did this in advance of Google coming and just, you know, tromping all over the site for, you know, site reputation abuse. Of course, in making a migration of that sort, of that size, you're going to get the attention of Google, because Google's like, hey, something really major happened over there. Let's go look, because that's what Google does, right? So if they were trying to protect themselves from the site reputation abuse crackdown that everybody on Earth knew was coming.
Well, them too. They were directly notified, so it's not like they didn't know.
So what's the decision of making a, you know, major file structure migration? What's the deal on that? What do you do? Well, why would you do that?
The only thing I can figure is they didn't know that Google has a policy against circumvention of algorithmic issues. It showed up first in Penguin. People would like create new sites and Google would figure out who they were and they would kill that new site. So they probably didn't know that and probably thought they were going to get out of the devaluation. Because remember, Google de-indexed these sites.
So your first contention, just like mine, and what I'm saying is an assumption. They were trying to avoid what they knew was coming.
No,
they see the train of coming, and they stepping off the track.
They had already been hit a bit from the first set of whatever went out, because we were never confirmed. We're pretty sure they were manual, because they said that they didn't do algorithms. So they already hit by that. So they're probably just trying to see if they moved it to the main domain and made it part of the main domain, then it was, you know, on site and it wasn't separate content and all the things that they probably got wrong. That's the only thing I can think of, because there is a Twitter thread where they say they're testing something. They weren't trying to circumvent. And Google did come out and do the hammer down on all these sites that use site reputation abuse, which is using like a really well-known site with a lot of power to like rank your ad stuff. So, you know, Forbes was selling CBD gummies. Not related to Forbes at all. So the Twitter thread says that they didn't know, and the hammer did come after they did it. So
okay, so they're trying to mitigate the manual hand of Google.
Yes.
And in doing this, they go from the subdirectory back into the root structure. And again, the point that I can see that. But the point that drives me crazy is, in doing so, you're going to trigger a crawl. That 100% is going to happen.
Well, you know,
and you're saying that they just weren't thinking that, you know, Google has a policy about trying to, you know, circumvent penalties. Well, so they got. By the way, the moral of the story is they got whacked again.
Yes, basically, but they got whacked hard. These sites all got completely de-indexed. I mean, not the whole site, obviously. Forbes has to be in Google.
But their whole spams area.
Yeah, gone. Their spam areas are gone. And I actually didn't know that Google had an official policy about circumvention. We just know it happens, you know, when you try to get around the algorithmic devaluations. But they have a written policy on it. So it says if you engage in actions intended to bypass our spam or content policies for Google search, undermine restrictions placed on content, a site or an account, or otherwise continue to distribute content that has been removed or made ineligible from surfacing, we may take appropriate action, which could include restricting or removing eligibility for some of our search features, help stories discover. Circumvention includes, but is not limited to, creating or using multiple sites or other methods intended to distribute content or engage in behavior that was previously prohibited. Basically, if you've been hit with an algorithmic devaluation, do not move that content somewhere else because they will come and find you and they will remove that content as well. So,
again, to the SEOs over at Forbes Advisors, I'm really curious, why did you make that decision? What were you doing?
I probably don't know. You and I work with recoveries all the time. We work with the devaluations. These are people that were hired, because I've seen the ads for the jobs, just to do, like, the job of the SEO is just to do CBD gummies. That's like your job. So these are not probably people well-versed in how Google, you know, handles devaluations, because Forbes doesn't get devaluations.
HR department at Forbes, why did you make that decision? You hired people who didn't know what they were doing.
Well, I mean, I didn't know what they were doing for general SEO, but definitely not for Google algorithms and updates, which is a problem in the industry right now. We know that.
Well, but, again, I had to talk to you about this story beforehand because I had to swear a whole bunch.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Because it's such a stupid decision. Oh, my God.
It is. And these sites did get completely de-indexed. One good thing, though, I work with a coupon site, and they had been struggling to retain everything, regain some traction that they had. And I figured it might be these coupon sites from the main domains. And lo and behold, since this happened, it could be a core update, but I don't think so. Since this happened, they have spiked dramatically. So,
well, yeah, but like I remember talking that these guys, I think your coupon site just got caught in a too large net.
No,
and they shouldn't have been there in the first place. They have a reason to do what they're doing. They are exactly what they advertise themselves to be.
They weren't devalued, but what happened is they got a core update issue. We got the core update issue back, but they kept going up and down, up and down, up and down. And we couldn't figure out quite why. And I kind of theorized it was these big sites that were taking up that space in the rankings. And so now that those big sites have been de-indexed completely, there's room for the smaller site who actually's focus is providing good coupons to come up in the ranking. So, because they've gotten a hockey stick in the last week since this happened. So, and they deserve it. They're like two guys who run a really good site, and they've run it for like 20 years. So they deserve that traffic. And so that's the thing too. When somebody like Forbes or something, and I get it because, you know, publications do not have the money coming in that they need to have come in, and there has to be a better way to do it. But they do take up the space for the smaller guy who really has put their heart and soul into creating, you know, good business, and they're taking up all that space just with the power of their site. So if you're a coupon site or a deal site, you're probably going to be doing a bit better now that these sites have been devalued or de-indexed, sorry.
And Forbes, just for what it's worth, karma, like capitalism forced you to sell snake oil. There's a karmic thing there, dude. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, speaking of things that should elicit really bad karma, this one you mentioned a little bit earlier, Google Ads is recommending advertisers spend more because that advertiser is spending less than the common budget, less than other than the average of people in their space would be spending. So here you are minding your own business with your ad spend distributed as you think you see fit. And Google's coming along saying you got to spend more money because the entire block net, all the people across the street are spending more money.
Yeah. So the image they have of this is you go in, set your average daily budget for the campaign. And for the example, they put $5. And then there's a warning that comes up and says advertisers in your country, United States, commonly use a budget of at least $20. Consider increasing your budget to improve your reach. So maybe you're just a small company, you just wanted to kind of try it at $5, and they're telling you, no, if you don't do 20, then we're not going to give you the traffic. So kind of, I don't know. See, monopoly. Like, really, this is not what you do when you're on for like 3 antitrust cases and have lost one and about to lose the second one. That's just my opinion. But so, yeah, so it's basically pretty straightforward. If you get this notice, it just means they want you to spend more money because you're not spending as much as other people, and so they won't give you as much reach.
Okay. So in a question about network requests, Martin split from Google, suggests, don't worry about it. Martin was asked about the cost of rendering, of CPU usage, and of, you know, how taxing this might be on a server on the Mythical crawl budget. And I think to paraphrase Martin, again, he said, don't worry about it too much. What I think he meant was your scale of big and Google's scale of big are really different things. So Google's worried about, like, 100,000, 200,000, 500,000 page e-com sites that never, ever, 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 ever end. Sites where they start going down recursive patterns of sizing and colors and, you know, just
like my
creating page after page.
Site with 2 billion pages.
There you go. That is a crawl problem for Google.
Yes, exactly.
But your 10,000 page e-com site is not a problem for Google. In fact, that's a morsel that it consumes for an aperitif before breakfast.
Yes, and it's a network request are in the same line. So the number of network requests that your page load basically makes is probably fine for Google. And if it's not, you'll start seeing 429 service status errors in your reporting, like Google Search Console.
So yeah, it's very unlikely that you're taxing your network, and it's very unlikely that your tax that a crawl is going to tax your network.
Exactly. Oh, and on the lines of things, this is a really quick one. Google has updated its misleading ad design policy for deceptive buttons in ads. Have you ever gotten one of those, Jim, where it downloads the ad and it's a big old green button and it's like download or start here or something?
Oh, so it looks like you got to push this to accomplish what you were doing on the page.
Exactly. I don't know why Google has had them around for so long, but it's called the play button sham. I like that. The play button sham sounds like a song.
That's pretty good. That's a good name.
And next year, and it's going to start enforcing. They're going to start enforcing it January 23rd, 2025, and then complete it by March. So just notice if you're using those, they're not going to do well for you after January next year, because they are very misleading. And I have clicked on them and been very angry because I'm like, I did not mean to click on that. So those will be going away. Thank goodness.
There you go. Okay. Where else do we want to go? We are so eating time right now. I think we're like at an hour and a half at this point. We still got a million stories.
I don't know why we've been doing a lot, because the stories are about our normal length. I think we're just talking today because of the holiday. You know, we should talk about Google killing Google Explorer with continuous scroll ending. So not a big story, but just some the Google Explorer that opens up at the bottom, these extra items for you, which I haven't seen in a while. It's only in mobile, and it apparently has probably been deprecated for a little bit of a bit. But they removed infinite scroll from mobile, which means that no longer appears, because it appeared at the end of the infinite scroll. So if you scroll so many pages in infinite scroll, it would add that to the end. I thought it was a really dumb thing. It didn't make sense for it to be there. It brought up weird search results. It didn't seem to be related to anything. So I'm kind of glad it's gone. So.
Okay. Google has brought and rolled out Search Console recommendations for everybody. So if you have Google Search Console, it's probably telling you what to do.
Yes, and the recommendations are based on issues, opportunities, or configuration. It'll help you prioritize your search optimization efforts, I guess. My only issue with it is they're putting it in a prominent place, so clients are going to go, shouldn't we do this? Shouldn't we do this? Shouldn't we do this? It'll be like, no. Because it's probably not related to what you're doing at the time or your strategy. So,
if for you, Search Console opens on the, I think it's the overview screen, then you'll probably see recommendations. Now, for people who don't have SEOs helping them, the recommendations will certainly lead you to think about things on your website. For SEOs, the recommendations might make a lot of sense. You know, there may be very good reasons for seeing them, or you may look at them and understand why you didn't do what they're suggesting.
Right, exactly. Yeah. My issue is the prominence of them, so.
Yeah, they're not well contextualized, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And there's a number of reasons why an SEO or why a website owner might make a decision, and Google might see it differently.
Yes, and a site owner who doesn't know those things but has access is probably going to ask questions. In the early days, you kind of just got to train them to go, I know. It's okay. We're not working on that right now. We're working on other things, but we'll attend to that later. And I know it gives a lot of, it's going to come from like the insights we get now. And it's like, this page is down 40%. It's like not a keyword you care about, and it's not an important page. And it 40% is like, it went from 10 to 5 or 10 to 6. So you just have to watch out for that.
Take a look at the recommendations. Read through them, of course. Don't ignore them. There's a reason they're being recommended, but contextualize them.
Yes, exactly. Next is a real quick one, of a frustrating one. I went to find out there's a site crawl that wasn't working, and I went to Google and I put site colon domain, and I was going to look at the number of pages Google had, and they were not there. It was blank and empty. And so it was blank and empty for a week until today. It came back, thank goodness. And then Danny wrote something about you could use trends and it's cluttering up the page. And none of those are real reasons because, one, you can't use trends for this. And two, the page is already cluttered. So the little hidden number under tools is not adding to any clutter issue.
Okay. So in search, you used to be able to say type a domain name and up would come all the websites associated with that domain name. And there'd be a little number, 4,280. And you'd know that Google had approximately 4,280 URLs from that website in their index.
And it's not always accurate, but at least you have an idea. It's 4,000, not 10. It's
or 10 it could be 4,000 associated 4, with that URL in the index.
Exactly.
Great. Now you know what you're dealing with.
Yes, exactly. It's great for pricing.
Now, for webmasters and SEOs, that was a useful tool. But I think for, you know, say a journalist, that tool could give you a false impression about how important a keyword was. The keyword blue was mentioned 3,878,000,000 times, showing it's much more relevant than the keyword red, which was only mentioned 1,008,000. And you know what I mean? Like that number needs, there's a reason those numbers exist. They need to be contextualized. And I don't think Google did a good job when it just threw the number up there, associated pages or number of URLs or whatever. Because you knew what that was all about, Christine. I had an idea what it was all about, but I saw that was misused in the media so frequently.
But I would go with that if they hadn't hidden it under tools for site colon. Like, I don't even think I was getting it anymore for regular searches. Maybe I was. I'm not sure. But it's hidden under site colon. So if a journalist knows to do site colon and they go look under tools, okay. More power to them.
But back at you, Danny Sullivan.
We need that information for a lot of reasons.
Well, yeah, and for what it's worth, Danny, you know trends doesn't do that for us.
I mean, I appreciate Danny. I know he's just doing and saying what he's supposed to for Google.
But
trends is not a substitute for knowing how many pages Google has referenced or has, you know, something about. Because when this site crawl wasn't working, it was getting like 92 pages. And when I looked it up the first time when it was still showing, it was like, no, there's 20,000 pages. So it's like, okay, obviously there's something really wrong with the crawl.
You know, if only there was a convenient set of tools that SEOs could use to understand Google's perception of a website. If only, eh?
Yeah. But still, when I go to price something, it's very easy to just do that. So,
You know what? Put that in Search Console. Seriously, you want to keep it away from public view? I understand that. But put it in Search Console. Let us have that information.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Like, put it there because we just need it. And here's a quick one. It's an odd one to me. Google AI Overviews is being put in card and block format as a test, which means you're going to get like a rounded corners background in purple or blue. And it's going to have a quick, short, like three-line answer as opposed to the paragraphs you're getting now. Which, I don't know. I don't understand the purpose.
This came up for me a couple times in searches I was doing this morning. And it reminded me a lot of featured snippets. It was useful in a way. I didn't get the answers I was looking for from it, but I did get directed to other pages where on the web page itself I did find the answer I was looking for. But the thing that struck me was how they took a couple different approaches to an answer and put them in these little rounded framed square, little squared round frames, with a little arrow feature to open the frame larger so I'd read the entire answer. I don't hate it, but I'm not sure it was necessary either.
I do not like it. The graphic, the GIFs people put up in the article at SC Roundtable. I like, there's just blobs of purple everywhere. Oh, it's like, I don't know. It just seems kind of silly. But anyway, it's a test. It'll probably go away because, you know, that's what happens.
Yep.
Google's also just, yeah,
depending on how people use them. I clicked on every one of them, by the way, to try to get to the answer I wanted to get to, and I'm not sure how Google's going to view those clicks.
True. But
did I dwell on those answers? Well, no, you're not supposed to dwell on them. It's a quick overview. But I read all of them.
Exactly. And as for tests going, Google's testing large, thick fonts. Now, we talked about this before, but there's finally some in the wild. And there's just like this, it's just, I don't need a massive, it's massive. It looks like a 72 pixel font.
A couple of weeks ago, they tested really thin squiggly fonts. So, like, you know, they're just balancing stuff out, right?
Oh,
the universe must balance. All engineers know that.
So bad. If you do usability or CRO, you know, when the text gets bigger, people can't scan it. So then it becomes more difficult to read, and then people don't like it. So they've passed, the size of this text has passed the scannable level. So now you have to try to read it, but my eyes are like, oh, I gotta read the whole thing now because I can't just scan what's there because it's so big. Now it could be the image is making it a little bit bigger, you know, than it is, but it's a really, really big. Like if I wanted it that big, I just hit Control Plus and then I make it that big. Like there's no reason to, I'll be like doing Control Minus probably down to like 75% if they do go with this because it's just so big. So,
okay. So
yeah,
you know ahead. how Google had the people also search feature in regular search?
Yes.
They've now brought that to images.
No. Yes, they have.
Okay. So there you go. It's now in images too.
Yes, you can now do it. People also search for images of these things. So another block of content.
Okay, so this is kind of neat. Google is testing arrows, buttons and stuff by the title by title links and in site links in search results.
You know, it does make sense to do this because it does indicate that it is a click that's going to move you to another page. But Google's been around for like 26 years, so I'm not sure that it's necessary, but that's fine.
If my competitor has one, I want one.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, like, if people don't know to click on a Google title in the search engine results, I would be surprised, but you know, it's fine. And then Google is testing the search. Sorry, Google search is testing product carousel snippets. Because we need another product carousel.
Every time they do this, it makes me think of they're trying to figure out how to get these carousels into AIO.
Maybe, because it is a little different than they used to be, because they used to be like you'd see half of the image at the end. It's a scrolling carousel like you see like on a website where you have pictures. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know if it's saving space or adding to it because they don't show the comparison, because it does say view all or go to the next set of slides. So maybe trying to save space on a page. At least the image isn't half cut off like it often does with the carousels. And when that happens, you'll get like, you know, 2 million impressions, but 50 clicks because no one clicks on the half image, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so these are full images and full carousels.
Okay, so Google is, and most large web publishers are prompting people to switch to dark mode. It's better for the environment. Doesn't create as much light pollution and uses far less energy. Problem with dark mode is a number of things like, I don't know, dark blue links or maybe a blue button representing a phone icon. You can't see them. So yes. Google has now introduced a gold color phone icon for websites that are in dark mode.
So and we covered the story before they were doing it with the titles. I don't love the gold, but it is for accessibility purposes, it does need to be done because that blue, I would look at it and go, how is this even here? Because it's so, there's no contrast between it and the dark mode.
So when you're designing in the future, if you are designing a dark-skinned website, use a gold button for phone, for phone and friend, probably for other social icons as well. That'll likely become a default, and it really does stand out against the black tone of the page.
And now we're just moving to the odd story that I don't fully understand. It's happening in Germany, Belgium, and Estonia. It's a test by Google. They're going to remove hotel features, which include the map hotel results, underneath the map, property info, and other data for hotels. I don't understand the reason for it, and it's not really outlined well in the article. But
I remember all those antitrust suits we were talking about before.
Yeah.
I can't draw a direct line here, but I'm going to guess, because this has, you know, they're making changes to conform to Europe's Digital Marketing Act or Digital Markets Act. I'm pretty sure that Google controlling how so much information about any specific property is gathered and displayed. They own the map. They own the information gathering system. They've remember about 4 or 5 years ago when Google started moving into the travel space in the big way.
Yeah.
I mean, just everything you put together, Google's whole relationship with recommending hotels, airlines, or any travel thing over the last few years, and I can see Google whistling while stepping back slowly from anything to do with what might set it up for a massive antitrust case in a jurisdiction that actually respects its laws.
Exactly.
Still.
I was going to say, because they don't care in the United States. They're still pushing forward. But yeah, if you actually look at the visual on the old way, there's a map and then there's a listing of two, like a couple hotels with pricing underneath the map. It says like your selection for date and everything. And the other one's just the blue links. So yeah, it definitely could be about antitrust. Unfortunately, in the United States, they hear antitrust, they go, let's push harder on being an illegal monopoly. But in the UK and the EU, they know that they're going to come after them and hard. And we know there's an $8.8 billion fine that could be levied tomorrow, or no, sorry, by the end of the year. So I agree with you, but it's just, I feel this is like a search change that actually isn't better for the user, because now all this information isn't there and they just have 10 blue links. So.
That actually kind of reminds me of how Meta and Google dealt with news in Canada and in Australia, where legislation was going to compel both big houses to pay news gathering organizations for articles that Meta or Google used and shared. Rather than paying the news gathering organizations, both Google and Meta just pulled out of the Canadian news market entirely. You don't share news across Meta if it comes from a Canadian, if you're in Canada. You can't. It won't allow you to. So that's what this reminds me of. Google's just like, you know what? We're just not touching this. We're going to move far away from this. We don't even want to deal with it. We're not even going to pay our lawyers. We're just not doing it.
Exactly. We're just not doing it. So we have one last story we do need to touch on before we end, and we do need to end because we have talked a long time today. Under goofy Google. Okay. We have some goofy Google today, like, you know, big fonts and things like that. Google search videos and overlay may reduce your YouTube engagement. You know, that new thing where you have to do a watch page for all your videos on your website and it has to be like the video by itself. Well, Google created their own version of that before they told SEOs to do it. And it opens up. You've probably had this experience where you open it up. It's just a white page and it's like the video, but there's not much else on there. So it's not like a YouTube page. That is the overlay page. And I hate them because the audio never works with the video. So I'm sitting there the first time I would get them thinking this is some weird YouTube page. And I'm like, why is my auto not working? I'm taking my headphones and I'm like turning them on and off and reconnecting them and they're still not working. And then I see the YouTube link and I go, oh, I'll go to YouTube. And then it was fine. So these are the pages between you and YouTube. But if you have a YouTube site, it also doesn't have all the features of YouTube. So things like subscribing to channels or looking at your playlist, things like that. They're not there. So if you see a decrease in your YouTube engagement, it can be that they're getting these overlays in between.
I think that really annoys me about this. And also annoys me about the video watch pages that stick as web pollution. Every one of those pages that you're talking about, Christine, has its own unique URL.
That's ridiculous. I wish Google would have explained the issue Google has and why we have to create those, because they did videos fine for many, many years. But they are, you're right, they're total web pollution because for people who don't know.
The thing is because Google can't figure out the difference between what's said in the video and what's said in the text. What's said in the video is completely different language than what's said in the text, but Google takes it all and it's applying it to the same page. Google can't work that out in its head. That's my theory.
That's a good theory because they're these watch pages. You have to look them up in Google Developer Docs. If you haven't heard of them and you have video, you need to know about
them. Web pollution.
Because they will not index your video now if it's not on one of these watch pages with schema. But the, yeah, it's just web pollution, because basically you have a video and then you have to have a whole separate page for it that's basically all white with little text, has the schema on it and shows your video, and that's a watch page.
And you know what? I have a client who's a major retailer in a niche space, and they've made literally tens of thousands of video representing their various product lines. They put so much effort into video over the last couple of years, huge, huge effort into it. And the other day we had the "you need to make video watch pages" meeting.
Yeah.
And I'm telling them straight up, a year from now and a year and a half from now, I'm going to tell you to reverse all of this.
Like AMP.
Drives me nuts.
Like AMP. Because I wish when they did stuff like this, it at least explain why it's a thing. You know, like AMP was a thing, and then now AMP is not a thing, and these are a thing, and they will not be a thing sometime in the future. You're exactly right. But your client has 10,000 videos that now have to all have their separate watch pages to get indexed, which is insane.
I mean, granted, we're using AI to create all these damn pages, but it's web pollution, and it's time, and it's money, and it's not Google's time and money.
No, they're very free with our time and money.
They have all the money. We have all the time. And speaking of time, we've gone way over time. This is actually probably the longest web call ever recorded.
It's a holiday edition.
Yeah. To the guys in the studio, happy holidays. Thanks, guys. Okay, we do got to wrap it up, though. Like, this has gone way over time.
Yeah, we do.
Christine, happy Thanksgiving. I hope you, had an amazing year and a whole bunch of stuff that you're thankful for. I know, and this is going to sound really cheesy, but we're really thankful for a whole bunch of stuff. We're thankful for our sponsors, Wix Studio and Audience Key. We're thankful for the guys in the studio, Ricky and Brasco, for, Darren and Brandy in the office at WMR.FM, all of our distributors, and most importantly, you folks, the listeners. Absolutely thankful for you guys. This is an 18-year-old show. And it's been around this long because you guys have been around this long. So thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. We really appreciate you.
Okay. So on behalf of Christine Schackinger from Sites Without Walls, this is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media, and y'all been listening to Webcology, recorded live to podcast on the 27th of November, 2024. Next time we talk to you, it's going to be early December. And, we only have four more shows in the first quarter of the 21st century. That just blows me away.
And this year went so fast.
So fast. Really did. So, friends, stay well, treat each other kindly, rank well, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, everybody.
We get it. After all the frustration, the endless cycles of hoping for a system that actually works, you're ready for something steady. Something that delivers without constant workarounds or headaches. That's why we're excited to introduce the 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM. Built with you in mind, it's more intuitive, faster, and smarter than ever. Finally, a CRM that sees your worth, streamlines your workflows, and gives you the tools to thrive without needing to prove yourself over and over again. Because you deserve a lifeline after all those outdated platforms. You deserve a system that keeps up with your goals and grows with your success. This isn't just a redesign, it's a revolution. Visit thebuzzcrm.com today. That's thebuzzcrm.com.